to the underworld. Come out of the cupboard, you boys and girls. London calling, now don't look to us. Phony Beatlemania is bitten the dust. London calling, see we ain't got no swing. Except for the rain and the crunch of things. The ice age is coming, the sun's zooming in. Meltdown expected, the wheat is going in. Engines stop running, but I have no fear. Cause London is drowning. I live by the river to the imitation zone.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to this week's episode of Action for Everyone for this here December 3rd, 2022. It is the boys back doing an old school Action for Everyone episode. No guest, catching up on some trailers, catching up on some movies, catching up on some TV, and catching up on what Liam's been doing in London. So I am joined, as always, by Vice Victus. Vice, how are you today?
A4E is now ASMR. Yeah, the crystal clarity coming in. My brand new mic. So you got, I got hot mic. So we got hot mic, like hot mic Scott. And now we got hot mic Vice because I got a new mic. Shit is growing. Yeah, how do I sound? Is it coming in? Echo, echo, echo. Yes. The clarity. A4E 2.0, probably. I don't know. Doing good. Doing good.
And coming to us from a hotel room in London, Liam O'Donnell. Liam, how are you today?
I am. Yeah, I'm in the yellow. I'm in low power mode on the iPhone of battery of my life. Had a late night last night. Went to Paris and back, and less than 24 hours, and got to see some old college friends, celebrate a big French dinner, and yeah, it was just a general good middle aged evening out. Like, we actually ate dinner from like 8 to like 2 in the morning. It was just like old people eating and drinking, like, and then waking up and feeling sorry for yourself but not actually doing anything too bad.
This is how you know how Liam's feeling, because I'm not sure that I've ever seen him wear glasses before. So, and he's, yeah, wearing his glasses today. So
it's a glasses day when you're this when you're this faded.
I remember before I got LASIK, I definitely remember glasses days. I remember the the contacts are not going in today. We're just gonna throw the glasses on.
Need an extra layer of protection. But yeah, no. So I've been doing well, and I wanted to congratulate you guys on a very successful episode last week. With, you know, we've always talked about the number of guests, and I'm always like, I can't go more than 4. I think it's too many people, and you guys really did a great job, kind of structuring that. It seemed to like a natural conversation, and it made me want to watch Cyborg again. And unfortunately, no Tubi in the UK. So I guess I have to figure out what a VPN is. But, you know, it was...
Call the ambassador. Yeah.
I couldn't believe I couldn't believe there's no Tubi over here. But yeah, congrats on that, on a great Albert Poon episode.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, you were definitely there in spirit. And, you know, even though it was a sad day, we celebrated a lot. So that was a good thing that we had that we did it.
Yeah, I feel like that was the thing we really tried to do. And again, thanks to Aaron Stewart on for pulling all of that together. And, you know, that was, again, his idea. I do want to shout out, before we get into Liam, why you're in London, shout out friend of the show, good friend of the show, good member of Action Twitter, Billy Jarrett, just underwent emergency gallbladder surgery. He did come out okay. He's in recovery.
That's great.
We love you, Billy. We're wishing you a quick and speedy recovery, man. Hopefully, you know, I think he was more pissed off about the fact that when he was in the recovery room, the Ryan Reynolds Green Lantern was on the TV. He was more pissed off about that than he was the fact that he had to have his gallbladder removed. So,
as he should be.
Billy, we love you. And we wish you a very, very speedy recovery, my friend. All right, wait.
I want Billy one. I think we were number one on his Spotify Wrapped. So I wanted to say thank you for that. And then two, Billy, it's now in your recovery. I want to see you throw on a tank top and join us in Meathead Twitter as you strengthen your body, soul, and mind and become a better action fan. But no, in all seriousness, get well. And looking forward to seeing you on Twitter again soon.
Love you, Billy.
All right, Liam. So you didn't just fuck off to London because you wanted a vacation. You're there for a very specific reason. Why are you in London?
Oh, it's the best. It's an ego bath. It's the greatest thing when you go on a scout. So yeah, we went to scout in an Air Force base where the Scott Atkins James Nunn movie One Shot may or may not have been filmed. It's a big Air Force base in Suffolk County, about 2.5 hours outside of London. And we were scouting for different locations for Skyline Radial and got to see Cha from Real Deal Action, and who is in Violent Night and worked on Violent Night. So something to talk about. I got to talk to him about, you know, blocking the fight for Obi-Wan and showing it to Ewan McGregor the first time, and you know, just some of the awesome stuff that they've been doing over the past couple years. It was really, really great to reconnect with him, reconnect with my visual effects supervisor from Skylines, Thomas Loader. And then, you know, just, you know, scouts to me are a ton of fun. You're kind of, I think it especially helps when you write in direct, because you can be flexible with these locations, but you're pretty much looking for spaces to, you know, film the movie and imagine the sequences there. And in some cases you use what's there and then you build a set connecting to it. And that can spur a lot of exciting ideas. And then we went into a city and we're scouting a bunch of streets and doing that type of fun stuff. And then there was a couple decisions about whether we will or will not use a volume stage, which was very much dependent on my experience on one of our more popular podcasts about the DGA day and whether a volume is worth it. I kind of don't think it is in this type of budget range. It presents a lot of complications. I think it's a great tool, but it's not necessarily something that you always have to use. Now I am flying to Thailand tomorrow and I will be there for the next 2 weeks, scouting and prepping the other half of Skyline Radial. So, it's been a fantastic trip so far. Managed to squeeze in some R&R and then I'm off to the second leg.
I actually thought you were coming home and then going to Thailand, but you're going to Thailand straight from London.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm excited. I need to sweat. I need to sweat off all this booze. I can't wait to go there.
I have to think, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, just, you know, as somebody who's not a creator, I have to think that one of the funnest things about scouting would be, you know, you've written this script, you've put these words on the page, but now you're actually, and as you're writing, you're obviously trying to like mentally visualize stuff, but you are now thinking about these words in a three-dimensional space, right? These things that you've written, you're like looking and you're thinking about them in a three-dimensional space. And how are these going to work? How can we, or what do we need to adjust or change? Or I have to think that that's just got to be like invigorating and exhilarating.
Oh, without a doubt. And I don't know, there was some crazy luck involved too. It's like we found this great city street that's going to work for what I need. And I really needed, I needed another part of a location and it couldn't have been too far away. And we go around the alleyway and it's right there and I had it. So things like that are awesome. But yeah, like you're saying, it is a weird 3D puzzle piece in your head. And it's too early to 100% think about, you know, the turnaround time and the schedule and how these things are going to fit. But you do have to, I think when I was younger, I didn't think about that enough. And I would be like, oh, I mean, this is just the best side of the hill. We have to do it here. And it's like, yeah, but you have to climb all of the gear up to the side of the hill. And it's only for this one shot. It's only for half a day. And you only have 30 something days. So all of that stuff it's just the experience of being like, what's worth it, you know? If something is worth going up that hill and burning that time, you got to do it. But, you know, it's all kind of a value system, as we've said in this before. It's like everything's a value system. Like what's worth the time, what's worth the money. And, you know, I just love I sat down with the costume designer and it's just a little bit of our podcasts are leaking into the pre-production of this movie. this is tank top cinema. I want everyone to have their tank top moment. So we got to figure out which part every actor gets the tank top moment. And like, look, I know it's post-apocalyptic, but everyone's got to look hot. And I'm just kind of like, I kind of thought those things before, but I don't feel like I articulated them as well in prep. And so, that's what I said. Thank you guys for the show, because I feel like it's allowed me to further articulate my value system and hopefully, you know, continue to hone in on exactly what I want to do here.
Yeah, you get this working vocabulary, tank top cinema, cheeseburger movies, you know. it's a whole lexicon.
Yeah, the hook people up, this definitely keeps coming up. And so I'm doing another pass on the script, because now you've seen the locations and there's little extra ideas, and then, you know, things could always be better. So I've got a ton of work on my plate for the next couple of weeks, and I'm excited. But it's just a great feeling to, you know, talk to production designers and costume designers and art department people and have everyone kind of start to get on the same page, because there is this thing where they'll be like, oh, well, what's the name of this? Why is it called a Hydra? I'm like, I don't know. I made it up like 12 years ago. It doesn't have any meaning. Like, I didn't think I was going to be in a room talking about this 12 years later.
Well, first of all, I just want to mention, like, you have on your Instagram page and Twitter as well, the costume design team doing all the work for the suits. That's just really great work. So you guys listening already, check out Liam's Instagram and, you know, see that great work being done by that, you know, the stuff you don't normally, maybe not normally think about too often, but it's a pivotal part of this whole process. One thing I have a question. Well, I guess I'm hoping or assuming going forward that is we can kind of have this show be also like a running travelogue or slash like a movie log of how a movie gets made, you know?
Yeah, and I was actually going to say that one thing, Vice, is that like everyone is going to really understand how long it takes, because when I'm like, hey, I'm going to make the movie, and everyone's congratulating me, like, congratulations on the movie. I'm like, I don't even start shooting till February. Like, you know, like, save the congratulations till, you know, when it's all done, to sanitize Harvey Keitel's version of that. But yeah, I'll let you.
Well, that's part of it. Like, you know, I think it's kind of unprecedented for me, at least as a regular normie guy, like to see the actual full process of a movie being made from inception to completion, the final cut. So hopefully, you know, in the next coming months / years or however long it will may take, we can see the full, you can expand on that process. So in this case though, in this, the scouting stage, my question was, so you have these locations in mind now, like actually in mind, you've seen them physically. I presume this comes later on when you actually start bringing all the gear back to the place. How does the local permit stuff work? Like, for example, you say you have this alleyway or whatever, like, it looks great, but like, you gotta like come back and see like the constable or whatever the hell, or the mayor or whatever they're called, and like, hey, how do I get my cameras here? Like, can I? And they're like, no, fuck off. Like, how does that come? That part come about?
So. Yeah, I mean, luckily I don't have to do much with that. And it's part of when you hire the local production team that they have all these relationships with people. And one of the great things is that my local production manager is dating a police officer in the city that we're filming in.
Nice.
So you know,
can't accept you, mama.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. All the stuff that that's kind of like why you hire them, and because they have all those connections and they have all those relationships, and they do the various paperwork. I will say, like, the hardest location, obviously, that we've ever gotten was the temples at the end of Beyond Skyline. And that I had, it was several, I would say, months of letters, and you know, our local production team in Indonesia was, you know, making all these, you know, sending all these letters, sending all these forms. And then I had to like write out a form that I would not destroy the temples, or do anything, you know, untoward. And so, yeah, we went through a very long process on that one, but most of them, it is just like, you know, you're going to be filming in front and, yeah, there's a permit situation and permission and money for, you know, renting the location.
Well, and it's somebody who lives in a state where a lot of movies are filmed, and I've got friends, you know, I've had friends in the film commission here too. A lot of it is also, you know, you hire that local production team because they're not going to take you to locations to scout that you're not going to be allowed to film at, right? They know you can film here, not here. And so they're not even going to take you to the place and show you the place that you can't film. They're going to show you the places where it's like, we know we can get permits for this. We know we can do X, Y, and Z. You know, that's, again, that whole kind of boots on the ground concept. You need those local people who have those connections so that they, because I can tell you, if you come to Utah and film something, there are 1,000 different places that would be amazing to film that you ain't going to get to film. Luckily, there's also 1,000 places that are amazing to film that you can film, but you need somebody that knows A from B to be able to show you, like, yeah, here's the place. Because again, you know, I know, Liam, you know, you filmmakers, you tend to fall in love with locations occasionally. And so you know, that's part of the skill, right? Is making sure you don't show the filmmaker the place they can't film so that they don't fall in love with it.
Yeah, I mean, especially like an unreasonable like asshole. I'm not one of those. Like I'm a dream come true for these people because I'm very, very reasonable. But I'm like, they give you pictures beforehand. Just I guess we're talking the process. So it's like I just got a bunch of pictures just before this podcast of the different places in Thailand, and if any of them aren't close to what I want to see, we'll just cross those off. We're not even gonna go. So it's like a kind of pre-select. I'm like, oh, this looks interesting. That looks good. There's like a waterfall that's not even like necessarily there's a waterfall in the script, but it looks so good. I'm like, I got to see it. Maybe I'll adapt something to it, you know, so that it is sort of, you know, I'm still taking it in, you know, so that's why I was like, I wanted to do basically after this whole scout do, you know, a draft that then reflects which locations I want. And I'm working on that mural board and putting the different location photos into the different scenes so everyone on the team can see it. So, yeah, no, this is kind of like one of the original ideas of the podcast to be like, oh, it'd be really cool to talk about a movie while it's being made. And of course, you know, it's better late than never, I guess.
Well, and this is... This is what I love about this, because this is what you're talking about. All of this stuff is just such a perfect example, again, of how even if you're an auteur, film is such a collaborative medium, right? Like, you need so many people to do their jobs, and you have to work with so many people. And that's a thing that I just don't think a lot of people give enough credit to. In terms of, you know, and we always kind of, that's something, you know, not to take it in a serious route, but that's something that we've wrestled with a lot on this show when we're talking about like creepers and monsters in these movies that we deal with. But it's like, is it fair to, don't punish the person taking pictures of the scouting locations for that. You know what I mean? Like the film is a collaborative medium, and it requires hundreds, if not thousands of people to make a movie happen. And so I'm really looking forward to us continuing these chats as you're going through this to kind of remind people of that there's so much shit on a movie set that you don't even think about matters, right? Like you're thinking about the person who's taking the pictures of the locations and sending them to you a year before the movie even gets made. Like, you know, and so, yeah, I think this is good insight and good stuff.
You know, it's like a, I was just going to say the thing that it's funny you mentioned that, and it was a little bit of like the last like couple of weeks beforehand, is that I got this like, you know, queasiness, is that when I was younger, you just have a lot more like obviously piss and vinegar, but like magical thinking. And I would just be like, it's going to work. This is going to work. And I think the experience of it is, I now know how much I don't control. And so I kind of have to like make peace with that. Even as I go in and like you know, give wholehearted to it. I know that some of the cast things, there could be scheduling problems, people could drop out, and that has a huge impact on the final project, you know, but there's literally nothing I can do about it. And there's literally like nothing I can do if there's certain locations or certain people, certain things don't work out the way I want them to. And so there's that like feeling, like, I guess before you're about to jump off the edge of a cliff and being like, I just got to do the same magical thinking. There's no other fucking way, you know? So I just, you know, I jumped, but there was that little bit of experience being like, man, fuck. All right, let's go, you know?
As they say, the no plan survives first contact. So yeah, it's like, it's interesting to hear you say that now. Like you're like a battle-hardened battlefield commander almost in the movie terms. He's like,
what is it? Tom Cruise said that. I mean, his life it actually probably is, but not mine. No,
no, but this is one of the reasons I've always been a little more forgiving of especially low budget movies. This is why I've always argued, and I've had people disagree with me and push back on me, but I think degree of difficulty matters when it comes to making movies, because frankly I think it's a goddamn miracle almost any movie ever gets made, right, given all the moving parts. Now that doesn't mean you can't still be critical of it, or you can say it didn't work or wasn't good or whatever, but you still recognize the mere fact that somebody got an actual 80 to 90 minute movie out and distributed, the amount of moving parts that had to fall into place for that to happen are nothing short of miraculous. I could sit here with my guitar. I own guitars, but I don't play the guitar, so I don't want to like oversell myself, but I have two guitars. I could sit here with my guitar and my mixing board and my microphone and record a fucking song and throw it up on SoundCloud. And yeah, it probably won't take off, but like, I can at least be like, I put a song out there, which I'm not denigrating musicians or anything like that, but there is so much less moving parts. So many moving parts there than there is in making a movie. Making a movie is one of the most unrealistic. Like, frankly, anybody that wants to be a filmmaker should probably be checked into a psych ward, because it's an unrealistic option. And I love you. I'm saying
no.
That.
I was talking with the producer last night. It was one of the guys at the party, and I was like, "Yeah, the last time I visited a college, I just told everybody like, don't do this." it's a terrible way to make a living.
Yeah, we even spoke about this a few weeks ago when we talked about Black Panther. Well, kind of forever, like. Even that, like, you know, that presumably has the resources of an entire corporate mega corporation behind it. But again, the plan doesn't survive contact. In this case, you know, like all the problems Googler had, of course, being the obvious one, that, you know, Chadwick was gone. Like you said, some shit you just can't control.
Yeah, exactly. That has such a big bearing on the end product. And it's not something that I ever like really thought when I was 32 starting, I was just going to be like, yeah, it's all going to work out. But the fear of the unknown is real, but it's nice getting challenged this week and like coming up with solutions in real time for stuff and feeling really happy with the direction of everything. So
yeah, and that was the one thing I was going to say. That's the other thing, you know, you mentioned it a little bit that you can't control. We're not going to talk about casting, you know, who's actually maybe or maybe not in the cast. But let's just say you have people in mind who are busy. And right. So, again, yeah. The juggling of the time frame, you know, this isn't a Marvel movie. You don't get to just tell somebody they got to take the next year off to film this movie. Like, right. You know, and so, yeah, but every step you're taking, man, I'm loving it because it feels more and more real. And you know, and we went through the whole cover thing, you scouting that and that not coming together. Every step you're taking on this one, it feels more and more real. And I'm fucking loving it, brother. I'm here for it. I am so excited.
Thank you. Yeah, no, I'm excited. And yeah, like hopefully, obviously going to be posting pictures in Thailand and updating everybody on the next leg of the journey. But yeah, I'm glad you guys, you know, wanted to hear about that. It was fun to share.
Yeah. I should make a movie here and from my house, because like I'm hearing you saying, like, you know, you gotta have the connections to make it. Here in New York, of course, there's lots of shooting locations. Like, for example, the Little Notre, they have like their own, like they have they're almost like defined turf at this point. They've been around forever. They survived several mayors. That's how long this show has been around. So you see all the time the street signs where it says shooting Law and Order, you know, and it has like the NYPD, because like, you know they'll enforce traffic laws and whatever so forth. But like, you know, I'm seeing that, I'm like, you know, oh man, SVU has turf on the city. But meanwhile, right now it's raining, it's recycling day for the garbage. They say it's still outside. Why can't I get the garbage man to come? Can I fucking bottle the cans out? Do I gotta make a movie? Do I have to put a sign up and say we're gonna shoot the Daredevil season 4 here? Fuck man, get my garbage. Anyway, yeah.
Hey, Beatdown Productions has to start somewhere, man. Like, I'm telling you, you need to just reach out to, you know, Elizabeth Debicki and be like, we're gonna film Big Bitches 2 in my house. Are you down with that? And I bet she'll say yes.
it's the prequel, Big Bitches Begins. You got to make a movie to make a movie. You got to start small.
That's we've talked about that so much on this show. You got to make a movie to make a movie. all right. Boys, this week was a ridiculous, and really not even this week, like literally like Thursday was like the most ridiculous fucking trailer day known to man. But we got some trailers. Good old fashioned A4E episode. We're going to talk some trailers. First one I want to bring up is fucking Cocaine Bear, because I am like, inject that shit into my veins. I am so all over that movie. You got Elizabeth Banks doing her best like Lake Placid, and I'm here for it. What'd you guys think of that trailer?
Yeah, see, that's a good comparison. Next thing, Lake Placid or the, you know, prior movies, like I guess. Well, I'll say this. The title is, you couldn't not expect a crazy movie like that, like a, you know, a kind of a horror comedy slasher kind of thing. But then, you know, when you read the actual story, like, you know, this is based on a true story. There was a Kentucky, you know, in the 70s, a cocaine drop happened. A guy died trying to do it. Bear found the cocaine in the forest, ate it, and went. And, well, didn't go on a rampage per se, but, you know, he was coked up out of his fucking mind. I was... With the cast, you know, Ray Liotta in his, for RSP's, his final performance, I don't know why I was assuming it would be like a hard crime drama that happened to have a bear in it. But, you know, I don't know why I thought that. But, like, but then, of course, we feel like, no. What are you, stupid? No, this is going to be, we're going to go nuts. And I'm like, okay, yeah, I understand. Yeah. Like, you know, so he's like, you know, this fun, like, you know, over the top slasher, crime, comedy kind of thing going on, a mix of different things going on. So, yeah, it's definitely suits its title for sure. Yeah, it looks like a lot of fun. I would say when I saw the trailer, you know, we saw it online, but I saw the trailer for a movie that I'll talk about later, in the beginning of the movie, and the audience kind of scoffed at it. And I was like, you know, which is, I guess, maybe how it should work, I guess. I don't know. Hard to say. Like, you know, it would just be, you know, the general audience like this. And somebody even said, is that a real movie? Like they couldn't believe that somebody had the audacity to put this foolishness on screen for them. But, you know, that's part of the fun of it. That's part of the, you know, as Liam says, the carny nature of movies is like, you know, just going to do the dumbest shit possible. And you got to come anyway. So.
Yeah, this 100% feels like a movie that's going to make like $5 at the box office. And then in 10 years, there's going to be a bunch of pieces on Fangoria and Dread Central and Bloody Disgusting about how Cocaine Bear is, you know, one of the great all-time horror comedies, kind of like Tucker and Dale versus Evil was.
Yeah.
Even Evil Dead 2, you know, like that, it feels, I mean, Lake Placid, people forget Lake Placid was a giant fucking mega bomb. Yeah. And, you know, and most people love Lake Placid now. So, but Liam, what did you think of the trailer?
I saw Lake Placid in the theater. Loved it. Loved it then, loved it at the time. I think I'm going to be the cranky trailer guy this week. I didn't like generally like go crazy for everything. I don't know. It's like, did any of these people actually done cocaine? I don't feel like there's like a ton of like actual experience or like real insights into these drugs. Like, everyone just uses them as like, cocaine makes you crazy.
And that, they don't remind you, Ray Liotta is in the movie. I'm just
okay.
Saying.
I mean,
but you know what I'm trying to say, right? Like, I feel like it's divorced from the actual like stuff at this point.
Well, like I just mentioned, they're not making Requiem for a Bear. They're making fucking this cocaine.
I get it. I don't know. I think I could have fun with it. It's just it did feel like one joke over and over and over again. Yeah. And like you said, I mean, I think I was just a little cranky on the trailers this week. I didn't go crazy for it. But I also do have a friend, Jordan Van Dyna, who I should plug this actually. His movie, it's a wonderful binge. He wrote the first The Binge for Hulu with Vince Vaughn, and now he has written and directed the sequel, which is going to be on Hulu, I think. In December this year. And I got to see it a few times with him in the early version and then finished. Very proud of him. He used to work with me at Hydraulics as like a VFX editor, but was always like writing these insanely funny scripts all the time. And he sold a script to Netflix a few years ago called Cocaine Hippos. So I might just be kind of like biased that they beat him to the marketplace.
Wait, let me guess. Is that based on Pablo Escobar's whole deal with his
yes.
private deal?
Yes. Yeah. And so he's had that one. In his movie, It's a Wonderful Binge, features a lot of cocaine use as well, a lot of drugs, and a great Danny Trejo performance. So if you Trejo heads, he actually is in quite a bit of that movie. It's kind of an ensemble, and you'll enjoy that.
Here's the problem, Liam. Okay, so two things. One, number one, the true story of this movie is really boring because it's a bunch of drug smugglers threw some cocaine out because they were overweight. A bear found it, ate a bunch of cocaine, had a heart attack and died. And the guys that jumped out of the plane died when they jumped out of the plane. It actually became part of a plot of Justified, honestly. But two, I can neither confirm or deny that I have hung out with people using cocaine. And I will tell you, they are boring as fuck. Like, people on cocaine are not interesting. They are not interesting. They think they're fucking interesting, but they are not interesting at all. And so you kind of have to, when you're saying, like, has anybody on this used cocaine? I'm glad that maybe they haven't, because people who have are dull, dull, dull. Like, just dull. So give me give me the fake cocaine bear, right?
You're the bath salt bear. Yeah, fuck it.
It's fair. Yeah, it is bath salts. That's all I was saying. Like you said, I don't really have strong feelings about it either way. Corporate-y, like kind of trying to do the cool kid movie, when it just feels like it's Tucker and Dale was made by like a bunch of indie dudes, right?
Not Elizabeth Banks, I get that. But I will say it does have Scott Seiss, who's one of my favorite stand-up comics. And if you don't know, he's the IKEA guy.
Yes, he's very funny. Yeah, I was kind of crazy to see him pop up in it. Yeah.
Yes. But to your point, like, I do agree. There is some truth to that, because I saw a lot of comparisons to Snakes on a Plane, to this trailer, you know, and that was kind of infamously like, you know, I guess the thought behind that was they were trying to, like, how do I say this? Falsely generate a viral campaign, I guess, like, you know, because the whole story behind that, like, it was based on, like, pretty much the internet wrote the movie, so to speak. Like, they got feedback.
No, the internet rewrote the movie. So that one, they actually made it, and it was a pretty, like, Snakes on a Plane was like the temp, like, title, and they wanted it to be like a real movie. And then everyone on the internet went crazy for it, and they're like, oh, we got to lean into this and try to make it funny. So they did a reshoot where they added all this sort of leaning in stuff. So that's why it's not all the way there. But I think this one, you're making a movie called Cocaine Bear. I mean, it sounds like they at least are appropriately calibrated from the beginning, right?
Clearly based on Elizabeth Banks' past, like, writing and directing efforts, you know, she's in on, like she's not somebody that's not in on the joke from minute one, right? Like, you know,
that's true.
That's who she is. So she would not have signed. I mean, she would not be doing this movie if it wasn't going to be this tone. Now, that being said, I am also a giant Snakes on a Plane defender, which is not a conversation we need to go down. But anyway, I'm going to keep us moving. But yes, Cocaine Bear, I'm very excited. I think it's going to be a disappointing movie initially, but then I think in time people will come around on it. I don't think I compared it to Tucker and Dale, it's not going to be Tucker and Dale. Tucker and Dale is one of the greatest horror comedies that's ever been made, in my opinion. I think it's top 10 horror comedies, so it's not going to be that. But all right, next one is Knights of the Zodiac / Saint Seiya, which is a wildly impressive. So Vice brought this up before we were recording, and I had to do some research on it because I kind of skipped over it. This is a joint Japanese-American production. It's basically Toei Animation and Sony Pictures making this giant one. And for those who don't know, this is all I've really got to contribute is Saint Seiya is a very, very popular old-school Japanese anime that in the wave, the post-Voltron Robotech wave of shows being sent over to the US to be re-edited, redubbed, and stuff was turned into Knights of the Zodiac. Toy Galaxy is a great YouTube channel. Dan there at Toy Galaxy has a great history on Saint Seiya and Knights of the Zodiac. And so it's interesting to me that they're calling this Knights of the Zodiac. But Vice, you wanted to talk about this trailer.
Oh yeah, just to say that, you know, like that, like as far as like IP goes, like this is a pretty big deal, like so to speak, in that like you said, this is a long running series. It had many the term reboot doesn't really apply to Japanese anime stuff the same way, because like it's a pretty normal thing for them to make newer iterations through the years of the same property with minor tweaks and so forth. Now, maybe the most famous example of that is the JoJo's Bizarre Adventure series, although that in itself is kind of a special case because that's in that property. It's all like linear. It's all connected. So kind of like Doctor Who. Like Doctor Who is like canonically has been going on for 50 years. Like that's the same story. So that's how JoJo works. But the point is that, you know, there's been many animes based on manga and so forth that have had several iterations of themselves. And Saint Seiya is one of those shows, or the properties. So you know, it's a pretty big deal as far as like this is a big full budget movie, you know, and again, like the fact that it's a joint effort, I think it sounds like they're taking this very seriously. Insofar as like, they want to get this to the widest audience possible, which is interesting because, like, you know, I think that maybe in America it might still be considered somewhat niche, even your anime itself is pretty popular nowadays in America. But and well, you know, people may recognize Goku or Naruto just even if they've never seen anime before. But they may not know Saint Seiya unless you're actually an actual full fan of anime. This is a pretty big deal. I think it sounds like they're trying to like make this that big of a name in that setting for the wider audience, at least in internationally American and so forth. Like people who never heard of this property, they're gonna come and have and hopefully enjoy it. So yeah, it's pretty excited about that. Actually, I'm really curious to see how it goes. I'm definitely gonna check it out when it comes out. So.
Yeah, I mean, just for people who don't know, if you haven't seen the trailer, I just want to read out the cast list. So it stars Mak and Ryu, who for those who don't know is Sonny Chiba's son and was in the latest Rurouni Kenshin movie. And then also Madison Eisman, Sean Bean, Famke Janssen, fucking Nick Stahl, Mark Dacascos. We're fucking a true international cast here, which I think is interesting because It is a, you know, I like anime. I watch a lot of anime, but I'm not like an anime guy. But what I do have a weakness for is live action adaptations of anime. Like if there's a live action adaptation of an anime, I will fucking watch it. And I will admit, most of them are terrible.
Yeah.
like the Gatchaman live action is unwatchable. The Phoenix Wright one that Takeshi Miike did is pretty good. You know, obviously the bar is Rurouni Kenshin. Rurouni Kenshin is one of the greatest live action series of all time. That is the bar. Creator's a creep. I will acknowledge that, but those movies are amazing. But most live action anime is borderline unwatchable. I paid fucking Fathom Events prices to watch the Attack on Titan live action anime or live action movie, and I fucking walked out of it. but this one is interesting because it is such a combination of everything. But Liam, do you have any thoughts on this trailer?
Just pure jealousy. I was like, oh, this looks like they're in my wheelhouse and they have more money than me. but I did not know that Sonny Chiba's son. That's really cool. And he's got a great look. So yeah.
Definitely a lot of pedigree here. They seem to be emphasizing that, like I said, like, you know, this is a long running thing. So they're trying to like bolster that with the live action, I guess, legacy, so to speak. So yeah. I'm interested to see where this goes.
Yeah, I mean, there's some pretty impressive CG shots and stuff that are beyond what I think you would be expecting. It's something I don't exactly know what the budget level was, but it was like, oh, it looks very accomplished visually. So yeah. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, McEnryu is going to be, and I'm not pronouncing his name right, but he's going to be a big deal coming out of Japan. And I actually think he's. Because I've heard him speak English. He's pretty fluent, and being Sonny Chiba's son, I think his crossover potential is kind of out of this world. I think he's got a realistic shot of being a global, you know, a Donnie Yen, Wu Jing type global superstar. So him alone, I think, makes the movie worth checking out if you want to get in on the ground level of what he's been doing.
Great.
All right. Next up, we got Transformers Rise of the Beasts, directed by Creed 2 Stephen Caple. I'm a little disappointed that Travis Knight, that directed Bumblebee, didn't come back for this one, but you know, Stephen Caple is actually a very, very good director. I love Creed 2. So Vice, what'd you think of this trailer?
So where to begin? So I gotta have to admit that I'm a big Beast Wars fanboy. When Transformers, the original baby movies came out, you know, like that is a huge nostalgia, iconography kind of thing for kids in the 80s and so forth. So I had just missed that era, but the Beast Wars that came out there or mid 90s was my era, and that was my show. But the thing was, like, you know, this is also in the same era of Batman the animated series and Gargoyles, which were critically acclaimed shows as well as being popular. And part of their success is that they didn't insult kids' intelligence. They were actual full-fledged stories, not just toy commercials. Well, for sure, it was a toy commercial, for goddamn sure. Because, they had, you know, so many, but there was also an element of awareness to that because, it's kind of hard to explain. Basically, Beast Wars, the property, the Transformers, is basically in the far future, the what they call the Maximals. So, oh my god, so nerdy. Oh my god, fucking nerding out right now. Oh god, I hate this shit. Maximals.
For are once, it's not me. I'm so happy because I know nothing about Beast Wars. So I am so excited. For once, it's not me.
Yeah. So the Maximals are the protagonists, as the Autobots were in the original show, the cartoons or whatever. They are the long future descendants of the Autobots, and then through some time fuckery, they end up on an ancient. Which we learn is ancient Earth, and they call the Predacons. They're the descendants of the evil Autobot, the Decepticons, Predacons. So in the show, they have some of the characters are nominal descendants of the original characters. So, for example, Optimus Primal is the hero leader of the Maximals. He is the new Prime, and then his whole thing is he's a gorilla. That's his shape-shifting thing. And then in the show, the whole thing, this is so stupid. Oh my god. So in the show, the whole thing is that when they land on ancient Earth, the source of energy for Transformers, Energon, is in its raw form, I guess. So they have to use their beast forms to shield themselves from the radiation of the Energon, the pure Energon. So they walk around like animals, like regularly, just like chilling out. And, you know, chilling out. They're each episode or each the season is of them trying to tactically outclass the enemy side, the enemy camp. And so they made a whole show about this. So again, it's a big ass, it's a toy commercial. This is dumbass toy commercial. But using that format or that the framing, they made these really interesting stories, really interesting characters out of this stuff. Like I mentioned Batman and Gargoyles, like because I guess and instead of things like because oh and the beginning is this was a all CGI, one of the earliest forms of pure full CGI television shows, like, you know, Toy Story, like full-on CGI. So they had a limited budget. So they only had resources for like a few characters. So that kind of forced them to make these characters actual live, breathing characters. And so, and the writing team was really good at doing that. So throughout the seasons, they had these small little arcs, and then they would, through some MacGuffin, introduce new Transformers, again, sell toys, but they made that part of the plot and part of the interesting menagerie of these characters. And the big thing is that what you learn is that when they landed on ancient Earth, this is in fact the same Earth as the G1 Transformers. Insofar, so in other words, they folded this new toy property into the real or canonical timeline of Transformers. Like at one point, well, if 80s kids remember in Transformers, the original cartoon, they have the giant arc ship that they land on Earth with, and they're like stuck in there for like thousands of years or whatever. So the Beast Transformers actually find the arc and find a comatose Optimus and comatose Megatron. So it's really interesting, like lore stuff going on here. And for kids at least, it's like, oh, well, we're using the old properties, making real stories about this stuff, but still, having fun with it, and making these toys, having a good time with it. And then it gets weird at the end because they had a new series at the 99, I think it was, called Beast Machines, where they go back to the future. Yeah, it gets dumb. And then they become like fugitives, like the Matrix, like Neo and Morpheus. It's just so stupid. But it's a whole thing. But throughout all this nonsense, they make these characters like real. Like Optimus Primal is going through a big change. He's becoming like a Mario. He's like a, kind of reminds me of, honestly, like in Star Trek Deep Space Nine, the way Captain Sisko becomes like just a kind of a standard commander to like a savior. Kind of something like that, actually. It's very interesting. Again, this is a kid's show. They're doing these pretty deep or pretty spiritual kind of stuff for a toy commercial. But it was work. It worked. People, the kids loved it. I got a good response. So the point being that, for at least for my generation, that show holds a lot of weight because, it has this actual like built-in characters and story behind it. Like, it's not just dumbass toys. It's like an actual story.
And one thing I do know, it actually saved Transformers as a property because G1 was fading. And so Beast Wars, like literally we are in a world with Michael Bay Transformers movies, honestly, because of Beast Wars.
That's what
turned it into a generational toy.
So then of course we had the base Transformers and also all kinds of different iterations again of anime crossover, new Disney Nickelodeon versions of Transformers that come out throughout the past years. But this is the first time they've returned in another form in a previous show on Netflix, but like now it's like their first movie, so it's supposed to be a big deal. But you're seeing the fabled hero Optimus Prime and this newer generation hero Optimus Primal face to face. It's like, it's kind of like a, oh shit, you're supposed to like blow your mind away with nostalgia. And it does for me, but I'm also looking at it, but in the show, the robots, they're animal size. They're like regular, the Transformers, the G1 ones are huge, like giant robots. They're like regular size robots, like, animal size. Like when you turn into a gorilla, it's the size of a gorilla. It's like that. It's like, it's not a giant robot. In this trailer for this new, what was it? Transformers Primal, they're fucking huge. They are fuck huge. Like the gorilla is the size of the truck. Like, so I'm like, wait a minute. If the point of being a Transformer is to hide in disguise, robots in disguise, how are you going to disguise yourself as a giant fucking gorilla? Like, I don't understand the intent behind this, but I guess they're like, fuck it. It's like, hey, people love giant robots and they love gorillas, I guess. I don't know. So let's put it in there. So I watched this trailer and it's like, I haven't seen Bumblebee, but I know that they kind of like not soft retconned the Transformers story, so to speak. So like, it's not quite the Bay movies, but it's like based on the Bay templates, yada, yada, yada. So going from that, it's like, okay, we have these giant robots. So like, what are they doing here? Like not, and so the trailer stuff, there's no actual like story in the trailer. It's like, here's the Transformers, and here's the cool looking fucking Beast Machines you remember from the kids, but the giant and fuck huge and like metallic and stuff like that. And I'm like, that's cool. But like, what the fuck is going on? Like, I have no idea what's going on with this trailer. Like, I just see the giant eagle shooting a laser into the bridge. And I'm like, it looks cool as shit, but what is happening? So to say, you know, I appreciate, we all love spectacles. So like, it looks great. You know, like they've definitely, refined the process of, well, base Transformers have always looked, to me, been the pinnacle of CGI melding between live action and CG. And I guess it kind of optimized, no pun intended, that process to make it a little, maybe make them lower budget or easier to produce, presumably. So this looks like a more like a optimized version of that. So you know, it looks clean. It looks,
okay. Looks good. What do you mean optimized? You think it looks better than the Bay movie? The
no,
CG?
I think it looks like I'm hesitant to say this. It looks easier to make, but I don't want to like throw.
I don't think you're wrong there. So I saw some of the complaints on the CG.
And, yeah, I don't want to insult. I don't. I'm not here to insult any VFX artist or like. I know this is a tough job, so I don't want to denigrate anybody like that.
I think it's a lower budget. I mean, look, I was talking with a friend of the show, and he's getting shout outs all the time now. Aaron was DMing me, asking me about some of the VFX on it and some questions. And there's some viral tweet comparing 2007 to now. And I said, well, you know, like Bay is like Cameron, you know, like he suffers no fools and he's not going to tell you if a shot sucks or not. And he's been doing it now for, you know, 30 something years. So, I mean, you saw in the ambulance press tour, he actually said some of his VFX shots still sucked. Like he's a pretty exacting visualist. And of course, those movies made so much money. So the budgets of the Bay ones were, I think, considerably bigger than this one. So, I mean, when you're kind of brought into VFX and you're working with it as sort of a first time director, you know, you're kind of partnered with all these seasoned visual effects supervisors, and their job is to kind of convince you to final the shot, like with as little amount of muss and fuss as possible so that they could stay on schedule and stay on budget. So there's the, you know, that's kind of the process, is that like when you're starting out in VFX, that all these people that are like way smarter and experienced than you about it are telling you like, oh yeah, no, this is good. Final. And it's, you're kind of sitting there like your finger over the trigger, like, oh, if I final this, like, this is it. And, so, yeah, I think there's definitely, it looks like a lower budget for the VFX, at least in general. Again, this is just back to my overall, Liam's somewhat cranky about all the trailers this week.
I actually think the VFX looked better. Let me explain why. Let me explain why. Liam, I see you shaking your head. Let me explain why.
Insane.
No, it's not. Because as much as you know, I am a defender of the Bay Transformer movies. Well, most of them. Fuck Age of Extinction. That can fuck right off. But
I'm going to recut Age of Extinction and The Last Knight into a trilogy, and everyone's going to love it.
But these designs are offensively terrible to the eyes. The CG, it's not about the CG. It's about the character designs. That's why I think the CG, like, yes, in terms of that scene where Optimus Prime and Optimus Primal are meeting each other, do they look disengaged from the backgrounds? Do they look disconnected from the backgrounds? Absolutely. But in my mind, there is no question that the character design of Optimus Prime in this movie is 1,000% better than Bay's busy ass, like, eye-bleedingly.
Okay, but character design's not the CG. Because no, if you actually just look at the CG, the quality is better. Point. Yeah, but
that's what I'm saying. Is, to me, that's why this looks better. Because even though the CG might be worse, the character designs are better. And so for me, like, value judgment, as you said just a few minutes ago, I would rather have a good character design with bad CG than a bad character design with some of the best CG that we've ever seen. There's no question in my mind, the Bay Transformers movies had a much larger budget, a much like more impressive VFX crew and VFX product. I still think Bumblebee and this one look, they're more visually and aesthetically pleasing to me. And I will take that 100% of the time.
Yeah. I think there's a shot in the trailer that they want to make it their marquee shot, because so much so they showed it twice in the beginning and the end, where I guess, I presume it's Bumblebee, that oh, I forget the name of the actor, who's driving it. And so, like, as Bone Beast does a spin out, the actor walks out of the car, like, and so, like, they kind of, as if he was...
It's actually Mirage, and it's Anthony Ramos from In the Heights that's driving it.
Yes, Mirage, yeah. So, like, that seems much smoother than, I think, some of the other... Well, because it's less busy, the Mirage design, it kind of... How do I say this? It transforms quicker, so it's, like, less of a... less noise, as it were. So I think that's what they're banking on.
I think you're saying less visually dynamic. Yes, it's all much less visually dynamic. It's much more sturdy. It's much more sturdy and boring.
But aren't supposed to be visually dynamic. Like, dude, I spent $200 on a giant fucking Optimus Prime. Like, I want the Optimus Prime that his arms come in like this. I don't want, like, bunch of fucking gears and stuff. Like that's the thing is, like, look, again, I'm a defender of the Bay movies, but part of the beauty of Transformers is their simplicity. And
that was pretty much my comment, is that, like, these look like kids' movies. The other ones were,
yes,
like, he made them into four quadrant event movies because he added all these other hooks into them, and he was not going to bow down to whatever their lore was. He's basically like, you fucking nerds. Like, if he heard Vice describe that shit to him, you could just tell May is like, get the fuck out of here. I'm gonna have Optimus put a gun to another robot's head and blow his brains out. That's what I'm fucking making. So I mean, there's part of that you kind of like I agree, like, they were always inappropriate films. Like, they were inappropriate for kids movies, but they made it. That's his fucking crazy ass showmanship made him into this huge franchise. And now with, like, Bumblebee, which is a good movie, and this one, it's like they've kind of feel like they're down to, like, a two quadrant kids movie franchise now, which is probably what they always should have been.
That's probably what they always should have been, though, right?
Yes, but I'm just defending this psycho last son of cinema Michael Bay for, like, being so crazy that he did this.
But you're Michael Bay defenders. That's what's hilarious about this.
I know,
defending him.
And I'm not the one who's, like, loves those movies. I'm gonna sit down and rewatch them. I like one and I like three, and I kind of came around on five.
I like one. I like half of three. I think the back half of three is some of the most amazing.
It's amazing
I've ever seen in my life. The fucking wingsuit, like, that's, yeah. But that's it for me. But, you know, again, like, yeah, that's my, and so that's my thing is, I think that, to me, this looks like a good Transformers movie, not a good Michael Bay knockoff movie. This is a good Transformers movie. Maybe.
Maybe. I didn't really love the first line that the way it was delivered. I don't know if it was the timing either. And that kind of sunk me a little bit. Like, if you think about that first, like, Transformers, there was so much care built up to when they started speaking. And then all of a sudden it was off the fucking rails. But I felt like all of a sudden this is jazz. This looks like a good place to kick it.
Why are you doing that? Oh, my God.
So there's plenty of indefensible decisions on those movies. I just I'm still just,
and that's I think we settled on it, like, when we were talking. I don't disagree with you. I think the CG, the VFX look noticeably worse in this. I just, like I said, I think that's probably going to be the title of this episode, is value judgments, right? You decide what matters to you. And so for me, I was very excited. I really liked this trailer. I'm also a diehard Anthony Ramos fan.
He's good.
Enough to get me excited to watch it. I wish they could have figured out some way to bring Haley Steinfeld back from Bumblebee, but nonetheless, yeah. You know, and I do appreciate the pretzels they're twisting themselves into to still make this somehow fit in the Bay continuity, which
I think I just saw something that it's kind of a reboot, and they're like, they're so, but he still looks the same, like, Optimus.
He's still the same Bumblebee and stuff like
that. Yeah, it's odd.
Yeah.
Anyway. Hey, shout out to Ron Perlman as the voice of Optimus Primal. So, you know, they definitely
also
have
another very good reason to be excited for this movie.
Yeah, him, and I think Michelle Yeoh is in this as Eraser. another fan favorite, I guess you could call it the. Oh wait, I gotta no, fuck this. I'm gonna write some more. Fuck y'all. I'm gonna. So one of the cool thing was in the show. Listen to me. So in the show, like part of the whole thing,
you've never been less sexy than you have the last like 10 minutes of this podcast.
See what I sacrifice for you, listener? I sacrifice my dignity to bring you the truth, to bring you the insight, the knowledge. I have the knowledge and the power, but no dignity. That's okay.
For the fucking Maximals.
Yeah, right. But no, so they land on the planet. They have the Maximal base camp, the Protocon base camp, and then there's like stasis transformers, and so. And they would land like they're in orbit, you know, it's time travel bullshit, space spaceships. So a robot would land, and it's like a blank robot, so to speak. So whoever caught it, whoever captured it first, they would have their new like either a good guy, bad guy. So like that was a pretty like ingenious way to like make new toys, like make new like enemies, factions. Like you're gonna find the robot, get to it first, like a new robot. And so they had a cool thing with like there was a female Transformer Air Razor. She's a bird. She was great. She was cool. She was nice. He had a tiger called Tigertron. He was cool. He was black. The voice actor was black. You could tell. You can always tell who's black and who's not. And they had a romance together. They were like they had this cool like you know like Shakespearean romance whatever. And I haven't totally nerd out now. Fuck y'all. Remember the cat in the tape recorder or that robot? What's that one called? The guy who talked like this.
Soundwave was the guy that was the tape recorder, and then he had all his tapes.
Ravage. Ravage was the Panther, the Panther. So what happened was in the show, because, you know, there were a few time travel, whatever bullshit. Ravage, the Panther, came back from the future to like, end the war. But he was, like, a top secret, like, black ops spy from Cybertron CIA. This shit was dope, man. He had these dope-ass guns. It was cool. The point being, they put a lot of thought into this, like, stupid-ass TV show for kids. And like we appreciated it. It was like, oh, yeah, they're rolling in the actual old mythology, as it were, into the show, and they're making these stories pretty cool. Yeah, it's fun, a good time, and you know, we have fun. So now I'm like, but now, as you said, they're making these movies seem like the kid movies that they should have been. But now I'm like, but wait, these kids have no idea who these fucking animals are. Like, how would they know? Like, they don't have any context to like this great legacy of this whatever that me as a millennial kid had. So how the fuck? Why would they even care? that's what I'm a little confused about. Like, but I guess the point being, like, does it matter? Is it giant fucking monkey? So like, kids love giant monkeys. So I mean, maybe that's the point. You know,
I
don't
know. I saw somebody tweet literally robot versus monkey, and to me that's like, that's it. That's the movie, yeah. Right? Robot versus monkey.
Work for Kong versus Godzilla, right?
Like Kong, Godzilla versus Kong did as well as it did because. Lizard versus monkey became such a big social media thing.
Monkey versus robot lizard.
Yeah.
Versus robot.
If it's as good as Godzilla versus Kong, I'll be happy. That's actually what I wanted.
Yeah. 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 And that for me, that's to me too. If it's as good as that or Bumblebee, which I really did enjoy the hell out of Bumblebee. If that's all I'm looking for. I'm not looking for this to like change my life. I will say this is my one hot take is G.I. Joe Rise of Cobra is better than any of the movies that we've talked about, but nonetheless.
That's not a hot take for me. I'm a Rise of Cobra defender from day one. It's way more my stuff than the Bay stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, 100% agree. But all right, next trailer. Let's get our cry on because that is, for all my issues with him, that's the one thing that James Gunn can always do for me is make me cry. The fucking Guardians of the Galaxy 3 trailer. Jesus, tap dancing Christ. That's a good one.
Are you a Space Hog fan, Mike? I could see you.
Oh, I mean, not.
But you like know other songs than this song, right?
Yeah, I don't. Chinese album on his shelf right there. I can see it.
But okay. I would not call myself, I was always much more of a, in that era, I was always much more of a Blur fan than I was a Space Hog fan. Like,
but didn't this age you feeling it that like these movies have been, it was 70s, 80s, and now they're doing a 90s song? Yeah, and yeah, I think no, that made, that I, also
aged oh, dust when that,
fuck, that I just realized that. Oh,
that got me. I was like, but that's a new song. I'm like, no, it's not new.
You're 30 years ago. Oh,
yeah, fuck. Yeah, you're dying before our eyes. So all my crankiness, this was the one. I don't know, predictably, that I really, really loved. This one connected with me. And it was like the continuation of the big MCU story that I actually want to hear, you know, want to be there for. So yeah, this kind of worked for me, hook, line, and sinker. And the fucking Space Hog was a genius trailer track, which we didn't talk about the biggie one on Transformers, but I did think that was cool as well.
Okay, well, I'm gonna roll this to the next trailer conversation. Oh, first of all, Guardians of the Galaxy, they're great. I'm not like totally emotionally invested in them like most people are, but I definitely acknowledge that like they're the best of those MCU movies, no doubt. Like they just as actual movies, as films, like they work. They work singularly. You know, they don't need any of that other MCU bullshit like connected to tissue to work. They're great by themselves. So I mean, just on that alone, I'm looking forward to this part 3 because I know that it should be, you know, based on the history of them all, among the better MCU films. But not having any like distinct harder emotion to it, the certain callbacks or certain shots didn't really get me like they did more people. But you know, that's fine. Like I said, I know it's gonna be. I'm hoping it'll be good, especially because. But for me, is seeing that well, James Gunn is now like the creative co-head of DCEU, the movies there. And I loved what he did with Peacemaker. That was one of my favorite shows of this year. We'll probably get into that in another episode of our shows of the year. That was just a fantastic rendition of not just a comic book, but like of this comic book live action era we're in. Like they totally like kind of turned around his head. And so I know he's done it to varying degrees with MCU within their rigid confines. So I'm hoping that he can like pull something out like that and like just kind of go crazy a little bit more. So I'm definitely looking forward to that. So now with the song, fucking Space Hulk. I love that fucking song. I have the Chinese album. Goodbye, yes. Violet Race. Yeah, I'm a fucking fan of that one. Yeah. So okay. So now with the Transformers trailer, they had Notorious B.I.G. Biggie Small song Juicy, which was kind of hilarious because it's a pretty famous. You know, if you don't know, now you know, nigga. But they don't say the N word because they can't because it's fucking it's a kids movie. But that I have been. This is gonna be a. There is a troubling, annoying as fuck trend in trailers nowadays where they use popular songs. Well, trailers will use popular songs, no doubt. But they do like these weird, sad piano renditions of them. Like, and they like jazz them up, like picking up some like sad orchestral movements. And I'm like, just play the fucking song. Like, don't do this weird like distortion of to make this fake emotion. Cause the song has emotion. That's all you need. Like, even another example, like, well, it wasn't in the trailer, but, when Spider-Verse came out, they had a Biggie song in there too, and like it just they played the song as it is, but it meant so much in that moment in the movie because it was, you know, Miles and his older uncle who would, undoubtedly that was his era of music sharing it with his younger nephew, but the music itself was great, so it transcended generations. That made so much sense in that moment with just having doing graffiti, and here is like trying to warp Biggie's song into like this weird like sad epic tune. It's like, what the fuck are you guys doing? What is going through your head that you would want to change one of the greatest rap songs of all time about, you know, being on the streets, coming from nothing, selling drugs, and getting doing better in your life to fucking robots, monkey versus robot. Like, what the fuck does that have to do with this? Not a goddamn thing. So now, Space Hulk, I mean, yeah, it kind of makes somewhat that makes sense. Space, yeah, you know what I mean? And, you know, and more to your point about Guardians movies and Guns movies have always had that dad rock nostalgia vent to them. So that makes sense in this regard. But still, like, the song itself is also kind of not somber, but it has its own little bit of melancholy, even though it's a upbeat song. Like, I don't think you needed to do that stupid, weird-ass, like, twisting of into a orchestral masterpiece to make the fucking point. You play the song! Like, in the other movies, in the other trailers, they just play the song because, again, Peter Quill, that's his memory. He remembers these 70 songs as they are. So that those songs play, and that means something to the character, and in turn, we understand that means something for the movie mostly. You know, that'll make this fucking fake bullshit, like the sad movement out of this thing. And to me, it just makes it seem cheap. It makes it seem like manipulative. And again, I don't like using that word because like everything's supposed to manipulate you. That's the point of motion and stuff. And but like it just feels too cheap to me. It feels degrading. Maybe is a better word to me of both the song and the movie itself. It's like, what are you guys doing here? You're just following this dumbass trend of the, like. Making these songs, like I even saw there was a trailer for a video game, one of the Warcraft, I don't know, one of the, some MMO RPG, and they had sad piano rendition Linkin Park's in the end, Because and like what?
Already a sad song.
Yes, exactly. Like that's a morose tune. Like and it's cool. It's futuristic, but it's also sad. Like why the fuck did you put an orchestra rendition with the sad the girl with the girl singing cursive in the end? Like what? The song already sounds like that. It already sounds. Chacha has a great voice. Like hey, I hate this shit. So if we have if you have any more to say about this trailer, you can. But that goes to my next point for this last trailer. So yeah.
I'm just gonna add. I agree with you. I remember meeting with someone at Trailer Park who cuts trailers in like 2015, and I was making fun of this trend then. And he was like, "Well, just deal with it because it works."
Oh my god!
Yeah. So yeah.
Fucking Gears of War. Like that's literally what started this. If for people who don't remember, when Gears of War, the Xbox game, came out, they did. They used Gary Jewell's version of Mad World that he re-recorded for Donnie Darko, which again, Mad World, Tears for Fears, Mad World, already a sad song. Like any song that has the lyric, "The dreams in which I'm dying are the best I've ever had," is already a sad song. You don't need to like downstep it, but that commercial was so popular, and that's like what kicked this off.
I gotta say though, I will push back a little on your advice. I thought both of these were kind of good versions of that, because they weren't so obvious, and I thought that the sound design and the way they were using them for each trailer was like a little bit more creative than London Has Fallen using London Bridge Has Fallen Down in a sad key. You know what I mean? Like, I think there's a real lazy version, and I felt like the trailer editors in both of these versions actually they earned their keep. That's all.
Well, and again, Gunn knows music, right? Like, yeah. I mean, Gunn, say what you will about Gunn, and Lord knows I have my issues with Gunn, but he knows music. His ability to pick the perfect song for the perfect moment. Here's the thing for me. I don't love this trailer, but, and this is something we didn't even talk about this, but I feel like we do need to bring it up. I also just watched the Guardians Holiday Special and fucking curled up in the fetal position crying because that fucking thing was so goddamn good. And so it's like, I don't love this trailer, but like, this is my frustration with James Gunn. When he misses big for me. He misses, like, the Suicide Squad. I cannot fucking stand that movie except for about 20 minutes of it.
Yeah.
But Peacemaker was great. The Guardians Holiday Special was in-fucking-credible. I mean, it is going to be a regular, every year, Christmas watch for me and Kelsey. It was so good. And so when I saw this trailer, I'm like, I don't love this trailer, but you know what? It's coming off the Guardians Holiday Special. And so if he's vibing, it's coming off Peacemaker and then the Guardians Holiday Special. And then now if he's vibing on this, I'm going to go where that goes. I am 100% all in going where that goes because I know it's going to break my heart and then it's going to like rebuild my heart and make me like, I'm going to walk out of that theater sad, but optimistic. And that is one thing that James Gunn can do. Maybe better than almost anybody working right now. He can break your heart and then he can fix your heart. And that's not nothing. Like that's not,
no.
I mean, that's why we watch movies, right? Like that's what we do this shit for. So yeah, I don't love the trailer, but I am very excited for the movie.
Yeah.
I watched that holiday special with like, all the cousins and kids when we were in Arizona and the adults, and it just killed. Like everybody watched, it was 45 minutes and it killed. Everyone had a great time, laughed through it. It delivered. And they finally did Swole Groot, Jack Vin Diesel Groot. I loved that. There's no explanation for it. But he's been eating his liver. So yeah.
Well, and that's the only thing is that, you know, back to the music thing is that, yeah, it's definitely not the Gangsta's Paradise and Sonic. Like, I'll give them that. It's not that fucking train wreck.
Well, and on that note, let's talk about the last trailer. We are going long today, but that's okay because nobody has anything to do today except for Liam passing out. But he's it's like 6 p.m. Yeah,
it's 6:40. I got nothing to do. I don't need to socialize with anyone. I don't care. I did that all yesterday. I'm good. This is my night. This is my Saturday night in London.
Indiana Jones and the Dial of, is it Dial of Destiny? Or Dial of whatever. Yeah, Indy 5.
Dial Detergent. The Pick of Destiny.
Okay, so I am actually one who has to admit this trailer got me. I get what people, the criticisms, and okay, so I think some of the criticisms are valid, some are bullshit. But as soon as that theme kicked in, even though it was the slowed down orchestral version, which is, I know what Vice was going for. And I agree with you. It would have been better to just have the true, like, John Williams theme, you know, but I'm sorry. He looks old. He looks tired. He's still Harrison Ford. He's still Indiana Jones. I'm still going to fucking watch this goddamn movie. And so it's one of those things where I'm like, yeah, I'm in, I'm good.
I love the original three movies. You know, so theoretically, I should have the same nostalgia everybody else does. But I don't, for whatever reason, which is not a good or bad thing. It's just what it is. So when the war came out, the Crystal Skull came out, I kind of was ambivalent to that one, and I don't. I had a good time with it. Although I had to, like, I saw it in like spates. Like, I started it, stopped it, and then came back. You know, over time. You know, it was fun. It was like, but again, like, so for, in that case, like, I know there was so much consternation about, like, you know, oh, he's doing this dumb stuff, aliens and Frasier, all this stupid fanboy bullshit that people were crying about. No, you know, I was like, you guys, you know, it doesn't matter. Indiana Jones literally has the blood of Jesus Christ in his veins. Like, that's been, like, that's canon. Like, it doesn't fucking matter. None of this. It doesn't matter what he survived or not. So, like, so I just had a good time with the one on its own, but, you know, but that one didn't strike me. As any, you know, that, at least for me, that definitely wasn't as great as the original three, you know. And I think maybe, I don't know what the consensus is on that, but for me, it was just kind of a, oh, he's back, yeah, I guess this is fun, but it didn't have the impact of the first three. So with this one, for the trailer, once again, I don't really feel any kind of way. Like, again, that I don't have that biting nostalgia, but more so, I think to me, it feels like a lot of the problems, the so-called problems of modern cinema are affecting this in this way. Like, the way somebody mentioned that there's a visual shot in the trailer where he's like, I guess it's a big parade in the city, in New York City, like the 60s, and, you know, and there's a big cavalcade and there's a big chase and whatever. And to me, it popped, but it also looked flat at the same time. And again, I think this is part of the thing we talk about. Like, we mentioned that some people can, I don't know, cinephiles or whatever, can discern the visual quality of film versus digital, but that doesn't mean that digital is bad. It just means that some people aren't using it properly or whatever. You know, because, you know, digital stuff can look great when you know what you're doing. But for me, like, it feels like it's so dumb to say. It feels like a modern movie, and I mean that in like a way that it's a detriment to what is supposed to be a classical, you know, pulp drama or a pulp adventure. So it feels off to me in that regard. But, you know, what's there, though, the set pieces themselves, they look great. You know, the horse, there's a horse chase in the subway, which is a cool thing. That's just a cool concept on its own. But yeah, it's like, I don't know. It just kind of washed over me. Like, he's good. He's back one more time. He's old now. He's great. And the girl from the show, the Phoebe Bridges, I don't know. I don't know who she is. White women love her. I don't know who she is. She's in this movie show now, too. I guess she's popping for people. I don't know. And somebody put it out. I didn't realize it at first. Then somebody put it out, and I watched it again. Boyd Holbrook, is in this. He's a Narcos TV show on Netflix. Was a great crime show. He was in Logan, you know, as one of the head hunter, as it were. And so, like, now I appreciate that. Hopefully, the people are realizing that again, he has a pretty face, but he's not meant to be a pretty face leading actor. He's meant to be a goon, and so they seem to be playing to those strengths, which is great because he looks great as a goon, as a henchman. So you know, I see this a lot of stuff here going for it, visually and cast wise, and but you know, the trailer has once again, there's no idea what the movie's actually about, like the dial of destiny or whatever, like no clue what it means. Which you know, the teaser trailer, whatever. We don't need that. It's just the selling point here is that Indy's back for the fifth time.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think that's a great point. Is that there and the dial of destiny is like, what the fuck is that? So yeah. Maybe that's one of the reasons where I felt pretty similar to you, Vice. I felt pretty flat on this one, and to just reiterate my love of this series, like I have the only poster that I have I have a framed, like really expensive Raiders poster that hangs over my bed. Like it's maybe my favorite movie. Love the series. I've gone back and forth on which one's my favorite, to be honest. Last Crusade's the one that, you know, came out when I was at the exact right age that I rewatched the most over and over again. So I feel like I actually have the most nostalgia for Last Crusade. But I love all three, and it kind of goes back and forth of the different strengths of all of them. But Raiders is just about as, you know, as close to a perfect time as it gets. I didn't love Crystal Skull either, and I guess what's bugging me about this trailer, or what maybe that not even bugging me because I just didn't have a reaction, is that it just feels thematically like they're covering the same ground. Like even the conversation between him and Sala is almost exactly a conversation that happens in the first act of Crystal Skull about, you know, time to hang it up. And he was kind of too old in Crystal Skull, and what was that, 2009? And I think it's maybe it's just like, you know, it's also weird that it's not Spielberg. I mean, it's been his series from the beginning. It's like very much his DNA. James Mangold is a fantastic director. You know, we mentioned Logan, Ford vs. Ferrari, which came out a few years ago, is an awesome dad movie. Talk about an emotional gut punch. I love that one. So I'm a big fan of him. I'm a big fan of everyone involved. I'm just kind of, it just felt like kind of more of the same, but he's even older. And I was like, and then like you said, there was no selling point on the story. So I was a little dumbfounded that people were so excited by it. But I guess it's Indiana Jones, so it shouldn't be that surprising. But maybe I was just more surprised that I wasn't more emotionally excited for it. And that's kind of like I was kind of like, come on, one more time with feeling in it. And I wasn't getting up. So I don't know what to tell you. It just wasn't there.
All right, so let me be the voice of positivity on this. First of all, one of the things we mentioned is Mangold, the guy that directed Ford vs. Ferrari, Logan, Copland, like, don't even think about it as an Indiana Jones movie. Think about it as a new James Mangold movie. Yeah. Because
that's a good point.
In and of itself is worth being excited for. But also think about any movie that boring, cranky ass Harrison Ford is actually engaged in. And so that's something where, because it's very clear, you know, if you've read any interviews with him and stuff like that, like Indy is, he despises Han Solo, but he loves Indiana Jones. And so anything that engages Harrison Ford to me is worth it. I think, for me, I'm not the Crystal Skull hater that a lot of people are. I think Crystal Skull is a very flawed movie. But I also think Temple of Doom is a very flawed movie. And so to me, they're kind of like, I mean, the things I don't like about Crystal Skull are worse than the things that I don't like about Temple of Doom. Like, let me make that clear. Like, I'm not saying they're comparable, but what I am saying is there's literally one perfect Indiana Jones movie, and it's Raiders of the Lost Ark. I love Last Crusade, but even that's not perfect. There's one perfect Indiana Jones movie. So if you're an Indiana Jones fan, you're always going to accept some type of compromises. And this to me feels like it's at least got the potential to do something interesting. You know, and you guys both said, well, we don't know what the story is. I, being the oldest of the three of us, I remember when Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom came out and all you got was a fucking poster and you had no idea what that fucking movie was about. I had no idea what Temple of Doom was about until I saw it at a screening. Because my parents got like free passes to an early screening. Like I'm expecting him to be like in some like Aztec or Egyptian temple, not some temple that's like underground and, you know, in India, you know, like, so that's kind of part and parcel for the marketing of Indiana Jones movies is that they don't really tell you what they're about. I will say, regardless of what you think of Crystal Skull, the trailer for Crystal Skull is one of the best trailers that has
that got me more than this. That's what I'm trying to say. Like that trailer was like, oh, I was very emotional for that whole marketing.
The trailer for Crystal Skull is one of the best trailers that's ever been made, regardless of what, and this does not rise to that level. This does not, like, I don't think this is a particularly great trailer. It's not the Force Awakens trailer. It's not the Crystal Skull trailer. Like for something that we're bringing, it's not the Creed trailer. I don't think this is a particularly great trailer, but I'm still excited for the movie. I honestly think this is probably the worst trailer of all the trailers that we're talking about, but I think that's a problem with the trailer, not necessarily what the movie might be. I'm still very
well. I do want to talk a little bit though about something that we've talked a lot about on all of these things, which is aesthetics, right? And like Vice was kind of getting at it about like franchise aesthetics and how far can they change. And it's just it is odd to see something that like the Indiana Jones go so far away from that, like, let's do a fucking pulp Lawrence of Arabia aesthetic. That was the original idea, which I literally, Lawrence of Arabia was on the TV here today. And I was just fucking, you know, kind of vibing on that. And I'm thinking, I'm like, this obviously, you know, David Lean was a huge influence on Spielberg. So I don't know that it is, it does bug me when something is like, it happens in music too. You're like, have these great bands that, you know, the famous one was Metallica, where you're like, what, you know, the everything evolves. And then you're kind of like, it's funny, on the back half of their life, they kind of go back to, you know, giving everybody what they want a little bit more. But I don't know. I just wish that there was, I wish there was a way that it felt more aesthetically like the first three films and visually than this trailer showed. That I think that's what is also the issue. And it kind of made a little bit more sense, or I guess I was a little bit more forgiving on the Crystal Skull one because it's Spielberg, you know. It's like, well, he's shot the other three, I'm gonna go with it. And so now in this one, it's like, as much as I love Mangold and all that stuff, I was just like, I don't know if this is such a good idea. do you think you can make a better Indiana Jones movie than Steven Spielberg? I don't know. Is there a win in this assignment?
Spielberg didn't want to do it, you know.
I get it. I'm saying from like the, you know, obviously you're not gonna say no to a fucking Indiana Jones movie, but it is just it's an interesting situation. And, you know, hopefully the movie is great and they ended on a high note. So positivity.
Yeah. At least we're not getting the like Chris Pratt reboot, right? Like I'd so much rather have this than the Chris Pratt reboot. So,
I do want to say, well, Harrison Ford is not, he's not Sloan and Schwarzenegger, but I do kind of, everybody who's old nowadays looks like the knees hurt. Even Keanu, John Wick, when he's running, he's like running like a bow-legged because his knees hurt because he's old. They're all old. Shit hurts. Harrison Ford been old. That shit been hurt. He was old when he was like in Air Force One. That is 90s. Get off my plane. But like, you know, like I'm seeing him do all this extra. I'm like, sit down, man. Like, why don't you just come here? You know, like.
That's kind of how I feel too. You're just too fucking old. I'm sorry. Are we ageist? Like, are we gonna get canceled for our ageism here?
We gotta preserve this natural treasure. This motherfucker is too old to be running around, jumping cars and shit. Like, why y'all do this to this man? Let him relax. Like, let who they have last time? Which whatever. Let the young boys go hire Jack Reacher, have him come around, jump and punch and run and kick, and Indy be like, yeah, do that. I'm here for the joint.
Like, yeah, sorry. I'm going to disagree with you, boys, because nobody throws a fucking wild ass haymaker like Harrison Ford does. Like, nobody has ever thrown a full bodied haymaker. Like,
but he doesn't either anymore. He's too old. No,
absolutely a scene in that trailer where he throws a good old fashioned fucking Jack Ryan haymaker. And yeah, no, I'm not with you guys on this one. I'm excited for this one. I'm you know,
I just feel like stories in general, like about people in their 80s are odd in a lot of ways. It's like that's the end. That's the happily ever after time.
So to do your 80s, Liam, you know that, right?
Do an 80-year-old action movie is odd. It's odd. I'm sorry.
Well, it's funny. Like, you know, Mango, when they did Logan, there's that famous line, or it's a funny line, Logan, where Professor X, he's like, they had, you know, Wolverine, we got to move. And like, Professor X, Max 2 was like, I'm fucking 90. Like such, you have to recognize that because it's old sometimes, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I don't know. This said, I'm trying to be positive, trying to keep an open mind. But
yeah, this is one I think we're gonna have some chats when this movie actually comes out, because I'm optimistic for this one.
I just want to see Indiana Jones. It's like, this is the 60s, right? So I want to see him meet Malcolm X or whatever. That should have been that. If he meets Malcolm X or whatever, I'll be lit, man.
This is what kills me about this, is like, Liam is the most like basic bitch taste of anybody on this podcast. And so the fact that he's like the grumpy one that's like, I don't like any of these, and I'm the one that's like, actually, I love all of these trailers. I love it. I love this dynamic, boys. This is why this show works.
Yeah. Yeah. It's again, a trailer is an art form. It's not the movie. So I might just not like this trailer, and the movie might end up delivering it. So I'm reviewing a trailer. I'm not reviewing a movie, you know.
Bad trailer. Yeah. I will say that. Bad trailer. I think it's a terrible trailer. I think the slowed down version of the indie theme, I think it's a bad trailer. But I'm still excited for the movie. But as opposed to the Guardians trailer, which I think is a terrific trailer, that's the contrast.
Yeah, that and that's basically what my emotional reaction was. It was like the Guardians one played the right notes and it got me excited, and the other ones didn't. I was half-hearted in one way or another. So
yeah. I'm totally on board with that. I think then that's maybe what we should have done. We've been talking a lot about what the movies could be. We maybe should have just confined it to reviewing the trailers, because definitely the Guardians trailer. Well, I think the Cocaine Bear trailer is pretty great, but I think the Guardians trailer is the best trailer. As trailers in art form, I think that's the best trailer of the bunch.
Agreed.
Vice.
So do we want to save because we're coming into hour two. Do we want to save Andor? I think we should definitely talk Violent Night though, right?
Yeah, I think we can. Let me really quick go through. We can skip. I'll let me get these out really quick.
Cool.
All right. RIPD2. It's a sequel to a Ryan Reynolds, Jeff Bridges movie that has no business existing. It does star Jeffrey Donovan and Richard Brake, and they are doing their usual sturdy work. The movie is not good, but it doesn't suck, if that makes any sense. I cannot say that I did not have some fun and some joy watching it because of the acting. And it's, the action scenes are reasonably well shot. There's no reason this fucking movie should exist. It's Universal doing their typical Universal bullshit. But I love Jeffrey Donovan. I love Richard Brake. So it's on Netflix. If you're bored, there's worse movies you could watch on Netflix. Blade of the 47 Ronin, directed by the almighty Ron Yuan, a stealth sequel to the Keanu Reeves 47 Ronin movie, which I love and nobody else did in the entire world. It's one of the biggest box office bombs of all time. That being said, Blade of the 47 Ronin is everything I love about direct-to-video action sequels. It's interesting. It's well shot. The fights are incredible. The cast is incredible. It has big time R-rated Power Rangers vibes. And somebody on Twitter was like, well, do you mean the Guyver? And I'm like, no, because the Guyver is all like body horror. Blade of the 47 Ronin is all about the power of friendship and a team coming together and accepting who you are, except they say fuck a lot, and when they cut somebody with a sword, blood spurts out of everywhere. Literally could have been a PG movie, except for those things. But I fucking loved it. I was flipping shit for it. And so that's also on Netflix. That is the type of movie that this show is all about. So everybody, Liam and Vice, please watch Blade of the 47 Ronin, because it's good stuff. And then Vice, you gave us a review of The Woman King. I watched it last night because it's now available on VOD. I bought it full price, and I had a couple issues with it, but by and large, I fucking loved it. And we really need to start talking about Gina Prince Blythewood as one of the best action directors working in the business right now, because she has got the eye. The action scenes in this movie are so fucking good.
Yeah, yeah. Just, and again, like I said in the review before, like, you know, especially having that cast with her, you know, I wasn't a big fan of The Old Guard, even though I had Charlize Theron, she was always great. But yeah, like the comments of Viola and everybody there, like, that's an action cast, even though they're normally like dramatic actors. But no, this it all came together with this one. I really loved the action in this one.
Well, and I think the thing is, even in The Old Guard, the action scenes are incredible. You know, I've sung the praises of the scene where they're all kind of in a line shooting all the bad guys, and as they run out of bullets, they pass the guns back and they reload them and they pass. And that's just so creative and so inventive. And I'm sure, you know, a lot of the second unit and stunt coordinators came up with that. But the thing with Gina Prince Blythewood is, she doesn't get in the way. She understands how to shoot the action. And yeah, the action scenes in The Woman King are tremendous. It was really funny. Not really a spoiler, but there was absolutely a part of the movie, and people who have seen it will know, where Kelsey and I were watching it, and then I just looked over at her and I went, "This is madness. No, this is Sparta." You know, basically, it's basically 300. Yeah. I mean, but it's an incredibly well done 300. I think the story, my review would be, the story is stunningly basic and cliched, but that's okay. I love action cliches. And what really makes it is the lens through which the movie is told, of this, you know, this perspective and this group that we haven't seen in action movies before. And that's totally fine. I'm fine with that. Tell me a cliched story, but give me a perspective that I haven't seen before. And everybody in the cast is just tremendous. So
I said Lashana Lynch, yeah, like, that's our next action heroine right there, and she's waiting in the wings for other directors to hook her up, because she was so good in this.
She was, but also fucking Viola Davis got jacked for this. Like, talk about doing the work. She did the work, and we also talk about hooking up your stars. Prince Blythewood fucking hooks Viola Davis up in this movie. So yeah. It's now available for purchase on VOD. I can't recommend it enough. So there's the three. RIPD 2, if you're bored, fine. Blade of the 47 Ronin, great, great DTV, watch it. Woman King, I second Vice's recommendation. Check it out, it's fucking great. Vice, you went and saw Violent Night.
Oh man, yeah. Santa Claus is coming to kick your ass. Well, there's not too much to say about it. Well, you don't have to go long, because the story is pretty simple. There's been many versions or iterations of Santa Claus is real, doing some kind of movie, there was even a Santa Claus movie, which was played all the time on Channel 11, which is a really dumbass movie. There's all kinds of twists and turns of the lore of the Claus or whatever. This one is the simple, down to earth, basic. Santa Claus is real in this movie. This is a Violent Night starring David Harbour. You know, so he's playing as the Santa himself, Santa Claus. And Santa's real. He's like, has his reindeer traveling around the world, dropping off gifts to kids. But it kind of play. And so this is also a hard R action movie, or action comedy, rather. And so he's kind of playing it like a Billy Bob Thornton in a Bad Santa a little bit. He's a drunkard. He's kind of, you know, of his rocker, he's pissed off. He's like disillusioned about the world and the kids and you know, everybody's being greedy. All they want is video games, you know, all they want is to just, they want material things. Nobody cares about love or the spirit of Christmas anymore, you know. So that's where this scene is at in the beginning of the movie. And so this intersects with this kind of a pretty strange, almost, it's almost like, here's this heist against this rich family, and then Santa shows up as opposed to the Predator. So the other half of the story is that a family reunion for Christmas, and involves this like a mega wealthy tycoon matriarch, played by Beverly D'Angelo, which I didn't recognize a lot at the end of credit because she's hot as hell, baby. Oh my god. But anyway, so they have this super rich family. They're there for Christmas. The family's awful. You know, shades of Knives Out, shades of Ready or Not, shades of You're Next. You know, just awful, spoiled, rotten, rich family. But then, of course, these armed terrorists / goons come to steal this big $300 million jackpot that they believe is hidden in the mansion. And so Santa, in his runs, doing his gifts runs, he encounters this house family. And then as the heist unfurls and they begin taking over the mansion, he's essentially stuck in the middle of it. He can't escape. And that's the thing, is that he's actually, he's kind of a part of how David Harbour plays this disillusioned Santa, that disillusioned. He doesn't want to help anybody really. And they kind of mentioned this throughout the film where, here's the thing. This is, I want to talk about lore. Every vampire movie has its vampire lore. How do the vampires operate, you know, so forth? How do zombies operate, that kind of stuff? How does Santa's magic operate in this one? So Santa is a real thing, but he also realizes that, you know, and one of the little montages where he's going around the houses doing his runs, there's like, he goes to several houses with like Amazon boxes under the tree. And he's like, oh, fuck this. he's being outclassed by the corporation, by the powers that be. So, you know, but that's a part of his story. Like, you know, he's seeing in real time people not believing in him, even though he's very much real. But he still, when he encounters somebody, a child in need, he does drop a gift. He's still Santa Claus at his core. He's still helping the children out when he can. But he's just very, very much detached doing so. And so when he encounters this, he's stuck in his house. They find a walkie-talkie that one of the parents gives a younger child. And the child is a true believer. She believes in Santa Claus. She's still that age where he's very much real to her. And so she happens to get this walkie-talkie while she's in hiding from the armed robbers. And Santa just happens to pick up, and it kind of becomes at the Die Hard, the John McClane and Alice situation where they're communicating over the radio. And so the plot then becomes, in the second half of the movie, how does Santa, you know, help rescue this child and her family and also get out alive? So it's Die Hard / Home Alone, you know, and with this magical man. It's silly on its face, and that's, the movie knows it. The movie knows it's silly, it knows it's ridiculous, and it knows it's also a horror action. You're here for the kill, so it's crude and disgusting, and some of the dialogue, you know, gross. Definitely not a kid's film, because there was like several kids in my screening of this, and like they were like talking like, I like my missions like my sex, I like to fuck hard and fast. I'm like, whoa, this kid shouldn't be here for this. Like, you know, it's that kind of an actual full on adult film, or film for, you know, our that age. So it's not a family film, even though but that said though, on the flip side, the movie itself has a lot of heart, like the genuine emotion that this girl, this true believer, Trudy is her name, has in this Santa Claus, in this like beaten down, world weary Santa Claus, and that's the core really of the movie. And meanwhile, with the villains, there's great looks and villains there, and this is an 87 North production, so lots of high end action sequences going on, and lots of, you see, I guess you could say bit characters at this point, actors you might recognize, like we talked about earlier, in Charlie Union here is one of them in as a supporting cast as these crew of robbers. And there's also before you go any further. I do want to avoid spoilers, but like I said, the movie is pretty simple, so like it's not much to spoil. But there is one thing I'll get to in a minute that I don't want to fully reveal. But so there's the armed robbers, and even at one point there's a set of like mercenaries that come to they increase the stakes of what's going on. I mean, and Santa has, you know, Santa's outnumbered, outmatched, outgunned, and he has to take him down. And so here's the part where I want to avoid spoilers, that the Santa himself. How / why is Santa kicking these guys' asses, as we've seen in the trailer? How is he fucking these dudes up? And so in this lore of this Santa Claus, this film, he was a person before, many ages ago. Like, and somehow he became this magical gift bearer. And what he was before was a warrior. I'll leave it at that. He was a warrior. And now he's become the saint of good tidings for kids. So he has rekindled that spirit in himself to fight off these goons. And that part, again, the heart here, it's actually pretty moving when this reveal happens of who he really is. It's pretty moving because, you know, this girl who's believed in him, she's like, well, whoever you may have been, I still need, we, the kids, we need you now. So please help us. And then that, you know, that kind of gets lights the fire of him to, the, you know, take them all out. So yeah, it's a very interesting, really moving, honestly, little detail there in between all this blood and guts and swearing and foul language and all these terrible characters. But it's going very broad, you know, lots of one-liners, lots of quips, lots of, characters playing their awfulness to the hilt. And, you know, it's going for that very broad reach, but I think that's where its strength lies. It's like, it knows what it's doing, it knows what it wants. Not trying to get any deeper than it needs to be. It's going to happen with the kills. The other part to Santa, like the magic. So I wonder going in, like, you know, wait, so if the Santa is in fact real and he is a magical being, how is he getting fucked up? Like, how is Santa getting beat up if he's like magic? Can he just, like, you know, stop bullets or whatever? Is he like Neo? Like, and so one of the things that I appreciated was that the movie, the Santa himself says, I don't fucking know. Like, he doesn't really know how his magic works.
That's
like,
funny.
All he knows, like, he knows, and again, this is part of the reveal. Well, when they reveal who he is, part of what they also reveal is that they don't reveal how he came to be this new being. They don't say what happened to him to become Santa Claus. They just say that he was this in the past, and now he's Santa. And so they kind of, I guess, avoid or sidestep having like, do some like deep logical explanations. That kind of reminds me of, you know, in Looper, remember with Bruce Willis and Bruce Willis, you know, like, when they have the conversation in a diner and they're like, you know, what if time travel? And he goes, it doesn't matter. It's like, that's, yeah, it doesn't matter. All you gotta know is that Santa can fuck people up and he has some magic. And that's all you gotta know. And yeah, I like the comedy of it where David Harbour's constantly, the people, when they encounter him, they ask him, how are you doing this? And he's like, I don't fucking know, man. Like he doesn't understand fully how his own magic works. And it's to the benefit of the story and like to the character too. Like he's just like kind of stuck in a situation and he has to just work it out the way he knows how. And that is by smashing skulls in. So that's pretty much the thing I suppose. So like I said, not too much deep into the movie to like discuss. But the main thing is, as action fans here, and actually for everyone, of course, is the action. And of course, like I said, A7 North, it's great. You know, the really well-defined, really pretty long take, or not one shot, but, you know, long, distinct sequences, full-on engagements with various goons. It's similar to the Die Hard formula, where as John goes through floor by floor, he encounters a set of goons or particular like henchmen, and he has to dispatch them in a certain way. Similar thing here. These specialized, recognizable bad guys. Have their own weapons and strength, whatever, and he has to dispatch them in their particular way. So that's really fun. It's really inventive. Lots of fun use of Christmas ornaments and the environment. And, you know, it's bloody as fuck. It's like, this is again hard R movie. Lots of blood and guts and not nice. you see every blunt head force trauma, every gaping wound. You see all that shit. It's but it does that. Has its fun and that's it. There's no clause to its thing or, you know, no shit like that. I mean, that's a spoiler. Like, it's not trying to do that kind of shit. But again, like I said though, there's definitely room to do so because again, they don't explain in full detail of how he came to be. So if they wanted to, or if David Harbour was up for it, I'm sure they could like have another Violent Night 2. You know, the Night the Reindeer Die, whatever. I don't, whatever they want to do, they gave themselves that space to do it. But no, as it is now, this is a great. You know, this is exactly the kind of stuff, you know, a fun mid-budget movie that you can just go to, have a great time, and then forget about if you want to, you know. But that said, though, I'm sure that once this comes out on Blu-ray and digital, there's lots of great kills worth seeing again, lots of great action sequences that are worth, like, revisiting and checking out, see how they did it, you know. And the last main point is that David Harbour, we talked about Harrison Ford earlier about, you know, how he has that one of a kind haymaker thing. And similar to Harrison Ford, David Harbour has this very unique talent that few actors in history have ever had. He can take an ass kicking, get the shit beat out of him, and look great doing it, as well as he can look good beating up people, beating up goons, whatever. He's just a big dad bod goon at heart. So he loves seeing him get beat around. Like, he's like a big punching bag, and he takes these hits so well. He's like, he you can just tell everything hurts. Again, he's a fat old man. Shit hurts, knees hurt. You can tell. But he's also fuck you. He goes like strangle you with one hand. So he uses that physicality to his advantage. Like, you can see him, all the hits he takes hurt, but then all the hits he gives hurt even more. It's a perfect combination of a big punchy guy. That you see his vulnerability, you see him get knocked down, you see it's tough, you see it sucks. But also when he retaliates and he, you know, gets victory or whatever of each opponent, that makes it that much sweeter. So it's a great feeling, it's a great kind of action iconography to have, this David Harbour. Which again, you don't normally think of him as such. He's more of a side bit character or whatever. Well, he has some heroic moments in the Stranger Things show, which is most famous for, on Netflix. He definitely has his hero moments then. But yeah, like having this, just again, this dad bod guy be this dope action hero is pretty cool. It's really refreshing. I really enjoyed that. So yeah, overall, yeah, it's a great time. I think action fans will dig the kills. I've heard people say there's not a lot of action, but I mean, I think it's paced well enough. You know, if the family, I would say maybe worst thing you could say is you could shave a good 15 minutes off this movie, and that way that was tighter, that much more effective. It's about an hour 52 minutes running time now, so you could definitely save up about 15 minutes of this, and it would be a much tighter experience. You know, but they took seriously the family dynamic, so they wanted to get into that. But I think some people won't dig that because, you know, they're annoying as fuck, which is, again, that's the point of them. But otherwise, no, it's definitely it serves. I think it's definitely enough action, more than enough to satisfy anybody here. Plus, again, the heart of it between the little girl and Santa Hill, like that's, you know, it's at the end of the day, it's a Santa story still. Santa, you know, it's a story about believing in Santa Claus, believing in the magic of Christmas. That's what that drives. That's the heart of the whole thing. I forgot to mention John Leguizamo is here. You know, the legendary John Leguizamo. Here's like again, you know, a very broad to the hilt mustache twirling villain. But it works here because, you know, he's great. He's great at those board performances anyway. He's a stage actor, stage and screen, so he's great doing that. And he has a first. You find out his personal vendetta against Christmas, which really it's a weird, stupid thing, but it really works again. Like this thing of believing in Santa, believing in Christmas, like, versus being out for yourself, being out for your greed and your own devices. It really works really well here. So yeah, I do recommend this for action fans in. Again, not a family film, but, you know, if you want to have your friends out, or, you know, if you think that your teens are of age enough, I think you can take your group out here and enjoy this, you know, and have a good time. And, you know, the perfect kind of mid-budget film that you can just jump in, have a good time, and jump out and enjoy the rest of your holiday. And they had a great time with this.
Nice. Glad to recommend that. So we are losing Liam. If you could see him right now, we are losing him. Going. So we were gonna do an advice and a yo vice. Here's what I'm gonna say. I'm gonna do these really quick. Yo vice, Shafi Malik, Neon Splatter, first English language interview with Guillaume Perrault of Lost Bullet. I will link it in the show notes. Make sure to check it out. Shafi, congrats to you, bud. That is a huge get. I know you know. Shafi and I are boys. He's one of my good friends. That's a huge get. Advice.
Hey, I just quick shout out. I was over in Paris yesterday, and I'm so happy you guys turned me on to those movies, because I got to recommend French action movies to French people who hadn't seen them, and I was like, what the fuck are you doing? You don't even know what's going on in your own country. It was a great, great feeling of superiority given to me. So I appreciate that.
And then advice is our good friend of the show, Maxwell Deering, asked, what foods or beverages would you suggest to pair with the John Wick series and or other long-running franchises? Vice, I'll kick it over to you in just a sec. I will say John Wick is super easy because everybody drinks and eats in that series. So, for instance, John is a bourbon fan and he drinks Blanton's. That is his whiskey of choice. Commons character drinks gin. He is a gin drinker. So the movie will tell you what everybody will drink. But Vice, as far as like some of the other movies, I mean, Fast and Furious, obviously, you got to pair that with Corona, right? You can't.
Yeah, there's no other way. Although, to be fair, there was, I think it was part six, whenever they had Mr. Nobody, and he's like, have a Belgian ale. And Vince is like, Belgian, huh? Do that too. Try it. Not Shock Top. That shit sucks. But try it. Like, go to a beer store. Nowadays, most even convenience stores have pretty wide selections of beer, no matter where you are at this point, because the beer boom has become so large now with the past few years. Yeah, try it. Yeah, try a different, you know, European style ale, Belgian ale. I guess you could do Beck's Heineken that comes European, I guess. But you know, try that too along with Coronas. You'll have a good time.
Stella, baby. And I saw someone saying, oh, Stella's a great beer. It's a great Belgian beer. You know, I like lagers and pills in my old age. I'm an occasional IPA, but I'm not gonna like do two or three IPAs. It's too much. So I like a light, real beer.
So the one thing I do want to shout out is there is a, and if I can find it, I'll link it, but if not, you can Google it. So everybody listening knows that one of my favorite TV shows of all time is Justified. And the creators of Justified, actually, there's a New York Times article where the creators talk about every character in that show has a designated drink that they use to like convey their character. So like Art, Raylan's boss, he's a Blanton's drinker. Boyd Crowder is an Elmer Lee drinker, say, because he wants to be highfalutin. Raylan, the only one that doesn't have a designated drink is Raylan, because Raylan will drink whatever is put in front of him, which is also, again, a perfect like character bit. So if you want to know how to pair drinks and food to characters, I actually really recommend reading that article, because they put a lot of thought into it. And so think about what, you know, like Maxwell, you mentioned Mission Impossible. Look, let's be honest. Ethan Hunt doesn't fucking drink. Ethan Hunt drinks fucking protein shakes. And like, you know, he's online, like finding like fucking supplements and shit like that. Like Ethan.
Yeah, he's the Tom Brady of action stars. He's not like someone that you want to hang out with.
The Tom Brady of action stars. Like, and he's like fucking Bruce Wayne. You know, if he's at a party and he has to have a drink, he like walks over to like the potted plant and like dumps it out.
You know?
Like Ethan Hunt lets no tainted things into his body. So, you know, so think about like that as far as how you want to do this. But a lot of times if you have characters that drink and or eat in movies, the movies will tell you that's part of their character. You know, obviously the most famous example is, you know, Bond, the vodka martini shaken, not stirred, straight up with a twist, which is the worst possible way to have a fucking martini. And that was the whole character point, is that Bond is fronting. Like he's a lower class Londoner trying to pretend like he's upper class as part of his spy job, and he fucks up a martini. And now it's like the most popular way to drink a martini. But the reality is martinis should never be shaken. They should never be made with vodka. They should never be made with lemon, you know? And so, it just look at the shows and they will tell you is my advice on it. I realize this was advice, not ad mic, but I actually had thoughts on this one. So you want to add, so I don't steal your thunder.
No, you nailed it, man. Like, yeah, the vibe of the show, or even the architect of the thing, will tell you pretty much what's going on. So yeah, just kind of, yeah. And these are part of the little details of whatever media was. Like, these things are character things for a reason, and then you can kind of discover why they do what they do. But also, like, it's always good to like, expand your palate. Just try something, you know, try screwdriver. You have a screwdriver before, you know, try Belgian beer, or try a German ale. Well, yeah, just try, give it a try. You might like it.
I have long been a gin hater. Unfortunately, my undying love of Ryan Reynolds required that I buy a bottle of Aviation Gin. And it turns out that if I know what I'm doing, I actually don't hate gin. So again,
I mean, gin and tonic is a delicious summer beverage. You never had that?
I have. I didn't like it, but I think the problem was that I had shitty gin. And
yeah,
and you gotta, you know, actually, my favorite version of a gin and tonic, this is going to offend the purists, is actually gin and liquid death severed lime. That's actually better to me than a gin and tonic with a lime, because it's one less ingredient. And frankly, liquid death severed lime is the greatest beverage that's ever been invented. So,
okay. Yeah. Well, you know, you just reminded me, I got to drink some because I'm going to the fucking jungle next week. I got to get my quinine up. So I'm going to be drinking them at the airport tomorrow.
Oh, you just reminded me of this. Like, there was a real about wine, the movie Sideways, when it came out in 2008. It was a real thing. Like, the famous line in the movie where, you know, they're wine connoisseurs.
I'm not drinking any fucking Merlot.
Yeah. And Merlot went down dramatically after that. Like, the actual sales of Merlot went like a huge drop. Like, that affected them. But I'm here to say Merlot was great. Give it a try. Merlot was not the devil.
But that's actually the Justified thing is true. That's why I can't buy fucking Blanton's anymore. Because fucking Justified caused a run on Blanton's. And so, anyway. Yes. If there's a drink that you want to drink from a movie or TV show, odds are you might not be able to get it just because it costs a run. But boys, it is time for us to. Liam is literally, he's holding on for dear life. Like, one eye closed that you do.
Yeah.
Tired. Vice, where can people find you?
I am still on Twitter till the reels fall off at Vice Vitus, talking all the shit. Oh, and by the way, side note, there was a big kerfuffle on the Twitter sphere about the Sight and Sound movie list, the best movies of all time, and they all suck shit. I don't know. I didn't read the list. I don't care. But people got mad about the list either way because, like, you know, oh, it's a new movie by a woman. Oh, I'm a fragile cinephile. I don't really care movies. Mm-hmm. I said I love movies, but I don't like movies. Why y'all watch movies? I don't know. Y'all are so stupid as fuck. Y'all so stupid. Anyways, what I did was I made the National Board with Nail in It, Sound and Fury, greatest ass whoopings of all time in the cinema. So check that out on my Twitter, and please add your favorite all-time greatest ass whooping to that thread. I have a lot of great comments, a lot of great additions by, you know, fans and professional journalists alike. You know, consider that's why we watch cinema. See bodies in perfect motion, see asses being whooped. We don't care about the sad painting and the sad portrait of a lady on fire. That's a great movie. I'm just saying. But he's some ass whooping. That's all about.
And I don't want to make a promise, but we are workshopping doing a 64 fight bracket for March, where we will actually declare the greatest ass whooping of all time. So it may not happen, but if you have suggestions, make sure to put them in Vice's thread, because that's what we're gonna go to. That's what I'm gonna go to make the bracket, and then the three of us will fight it out. So yeah.
Oh, yeah, so I'm over there, and I'm also on Instagram. I just looking hot, but also I have my full review of Violent Night, my letterbox. Once again, Alex, you check that out too.
Liam, where can people find you?
Liam Odin, Twitter, Instagram, and yeah, guys, this is a lot of fun. I'm glad that we were able to catch up, and yeah,
I'm glad to see you again. This is nice.
It is nice.
Just all you to know, we really did miss you last week.
Oh, well, no, it was great. And yeah, next week we'll figure it out. But I hope to be, you know, giving you guys a live correspondence from Thailand.
Oh, man, exclusives. Look at us doing big things.
And you can find me on Twitter, Letterboxd, Hive, Mastodon, and various other places at Hibachi Justice. But I ain't posting shit lately. But more importantly, you can find the show on Linktree. We have a Linktree. It's Linktree/A4E podcast. That's the best place to find all of our stuff now. Obviously, you're listening to us, so you know you can find the podcast anywhere podcast apps can be found. I do want to shout out, we got our Spotify Wrapped. We are in the top 10% of globally shared podcasts. We are the number one podcast for a significant number of people, and we love you all. I also want to shout out that, as you know, we did the Albert Pune episode last week, and Cynthia Curran, Albert's widow is trying to do a fundraiser, and I have retweeted it several times. I've donated it to it several times, and the amount of A4E listeners that I've seen on the donation list on the GoFundMe has filled me with joy. You guys are literally the fucking best. You guys know how to support the people that do this shit that you love, and we love you for it. So yeah, with that, I will say, Billy, recover soon, donate to Cynthia's GoFundMe, and boys, we'll see you next week.
Peace. Love you guys.